So I'd like to invite Nyaswami Asha to present this class this morning.
I want you also to know Devendra because even though I am visiting and presenting most of the program this morning, he lives here in India, of course, and comes often to the city, and all of the follow-up courses and so on are offered by him and other of the monks here. So this is, we're all working together as one team. I want to move this chair. Let me get it out of the way. Could you get that out of the way, and could you bring this much closer? Just maybe so it doesn't block the altar, but just like right there. Yeah, that would be better. I'm just going to draw some squiggly pictures on this. I should tell you ahead of time, everything that, as it happens, because Brian is with us, everything that's being spoken today is being not only audio recorded, but also video recorded. And it is our custom within a couple of days to post those on the internet, on the Ananda India site, and also Ananda Palo Alto, where I am from. And it's all free, so you can just go and you can watch it again if you have access, or download into your iPods or your computers or however you want to use it, which means you don't have to take notes unless you want to. And it's easier. I'm going to stand up here because I think you can see me better. It makes it easier. The topic we're talking about is the word prosperity. Prosperity is a very multi-dimensional word with all kinds of different implications. It means money, self-evidently, but also to be prosperous is only partly a matter of money. As a sannyasi myself, I've never had to work just for money. I've been in the ashram my whole adult life, so I have to honestly say that the problem of finding a job and holding a job in the context in which most of you live has not been much of my life experience. But Ananda has never had a wealthy benefactor ever. God has never gifted us that way. And everything that we have built, which is extraordinarily quite a lot by now, has just been built step by step by the solid, determined effort of the people involved. So in terms of the principles of manifesting, and also the relationship between energy and prosperity, between energy and the flow of money, between energy and the flow of all good things in our lives, I have lived this and breathed this for many, many years of my life. I live reasonably comfortably now. I have no idea how or why it happened. For the first 10 years of my life, and when we were at Ananda Village, Ananda Village started in 1969, bare land, you know, almost nothing there. I came in 1971. We lived really as primitively as anybody could live, and really primitive for America. We had no electricity, we had no running water, we had no indoor plumbing. The winters were cold, and I was unable, I always had a good heater. I couldn't live without good heat. But we lived on very little money. I did like that for almost 10 years. I was young, I was unmarried, I had no children, I had no expectations of marriage or a family. I have since married, although I've never had children. So there was nothing, it didn't matter to me. We lived for God and we lived extremely happily. We lived as renunciates. I like to think I could go back to that. I live much more comfortably now, but truthfully I found the house I live in rather a burden. It's too big and too much. I think I'd be happier back in my little trailer, but that's God's will for me at this time. God gives more, you accept it with gratitude. But what I really did learn during those years is the relationship between desire, success, prosperity, self-control, just all of those different elements. And that's a lot of what I want to talk about. And the beginning half of this, what time is our tea break? Do we have it scheduled? 11:30. Okay, 1 hour from now we'll take a break. I'm going to present a lot of ideas and then give you an opportunity also to ask questions. But I would like to get some thoughts clear before you start asking questions, and then we can go from there. There are certain principles of life that once we understand them correctly, then everything else follows from that. And I often see that a great deal of what is confusion out here is because we don't have the first premises correct. And when I meditated on this class, the obvious word that came to me was the word karma. Also because, of course, in India I hear that word very, very often. Now you also hear it in America a lot. The more you hear it in America, the more you realize people have no idea what they're talking about. And to a certain extent, I see that there is also some confusion in India, where the word and the concept originated, compared to the clarity with which Swami Kriyananda and Paramahansa Yogananda have explained this idea. So even at the risk, perhaps, of telling some of you something you already know, I would like to explain to you how I have come to understand the idea of karma. Because once we understand the idea of what karma really is and how to work with it, then actually then we know how to do everything else. So the basic premise of karma is based on, well, it's based on this simple idea, which is that our presence in this world is not without a purpose. And the purpose of our being in this world is more than just the little things that we're doing every day. And little things can include growing up, getting educated, getting married, having children, raising those children. I don't mean that they're unimportant, but it all depends on your point of view, how large they are. In the West, where people think only in terms of one lifetime, the only important thing that happens is what happens between birth and death. They don't have any idea what happens after death. They don't think in terms of reincarnation, God realization, nothing. So all of life is tried to be fit into this little reality, which is the particular neuroses of Western countries, which is just trying to become perfectly happy with what you can acquire, and this desperate effort to control everything, including death itself, makes people crazy in that unique way, okay, which is the world I come from. Although I don't really come from that world, I come from the world of self-realization. But the masters tell us, all masters of all traditions tell us, that what we are doing here is a means to a greater end. In exactly the same way that when all of you attend all your schools and your university, it's an experience in itself that must be related to correctly, but it's a means to an end. Nobody thinks that I will be a student forever. We think that I go through these learnings because then there is something else that I'm going to do, and that something else is what all of this is focused toward. Well, from the point of view of Sanatan Dharma, the teaching of this great country, the origin of the teaching is this great country, the point of view is that all of us, our divine souls, the jiva within us, the individual spark of spirit, is on a very long journey, and that journey is through many incarnations, and at the end of that journey, we will experience our true nature, which is one with the infinite, Sat Chit Ananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. And everything that we're doing, whether we're aware of it or not, is motivated by some part of us that knows that bliss is our true nature, and bliss is the true destination of this journey. If we didn't know that, we wouldn't be unhappy now. Because if the only possibility was what we have, it wouldn't even occur to us that things should be different. I really don't think an earthworm sort of contemplates its condition and sort of thinks about how other earthworms are more fortunate than it and live in better soil and wonders about earthworms in developing countries and if their world is better than its world, because it doesn't have any awareness yet of its destiny. And yet, even an earthworm, if you poke it with something sharp, it'll recoil and it'll try to find a place that feels better than the point where it's being pricked. So even at that rudimentary level, there is this relationship between the desire for what it considers positive, the desire to avoid what it considers painful. And I was speaking to some of you yesterday that all of life is motivated by those two impulses. Yogananda called it the science of religion. The science of religion is the search for bliss, the desire to avoid pain. I'm going to hold up a book, which I brought in from outside. This book called God is for Everyone is a beautiful articulation, of that thought. So just want to put it in front of you. So then the issue becomes, like university studies, what are we learning? How well are we learning it? And what are we doing with what we're learning? So we have to think about life as purposeful, but purposeful like a university. So here we are, and we're trying to find out what causes us pain, what causes us happiness, and what is happiness. And the truthful way is, these are the questions that we're being asked to answer. Who am I? You know, we can answer with our names, but even here I am, I can say that I am Asha. I am Naya Swami Asha now, but at one point before Swami Kriyananda gave me the name Asha, my mother gave me another name. So for the first years of my life, I didn't even have this name. When I married, I took my husband's name and abandoned my father's name. So my name has shifted. First and last name has shifted several times. My passport now reads differently than my school papers read when I was a child. My personality was not so different when I was young, but I was a small person doing all sorts of things, never imagining I'd be standing here. I mean, that's the most superficial confusion when we answer the question, who am I? But what we're really looking for is answers to these questions that are not so dependent upon circumstances that are always changing. Because even now, if we say, I am a person who plays the violin, there was a woman in America who played the cello. She played the cello exquisitely, and her whole life had been dedicated to playing the cello, and her husband was a music conductor, and they had this extraordinary life together. And then she was afflicted with a debilitating illness that took away her muscle control. And all of a sudden, this whole definition of being a cellist was just taken away from her. To her credit, toward the end of her life, when this disease was taking her life rather young, someone said to her, you know, seeing it from their point of view, how unhappy you must be not to be able to play the music anymore. And she, with this beatific smile, said, oh, but it still plays inside of me all the time. Now, you see, she was learning. You would look at, and I mean, I never knew her personally. I just read her story in the paper, and it, because I had heard her music, it touched my heart so deeply to see her life seeming to be have taken apart in that way. But she had begun to answer the question, who am I, in a way that was less dependent on circumstances that were ephemeral at best. Her ability to play the cello was taken away from her young, but sooner or later it would have been taken away, either taken away by advancing age, by some other disease, or by death itself. So all the way through our lives, one of the first questions about pain versus bliss is the question of who am I? And whenever anything happens to us, we answer that question in a certain way. I am this body, I am this profession, I am this person's daughter, this person's husband, the father of so-and-so, the child of so-and-so. Whatever it might be, we're always answering that question. And it's not a matter of what you can spin with your mind. You know, intellectual ideas, and I am the infinite Atman, or whatever it is that you can say. It's a question of what is really true for you on a level that is not about thought, but is what the vibration of reality that we actually live on. I can talk really eloquently about not identifying with the body, only identifying with the spirit, how we are really one with the spirit, how death comes to everyone. And then I'm in an automobile on the freeway, and somebody looks like they're going to crash into me, and I freak. I get very nervous like this, because I think something's going to happen to me at that moment. I do not have the state of realization that can just calmly accept that my body is going to be smashed. And it's very helpful to realize that the way we respond in the moment, in the instant when we can't think about it, is really the vibration that we work on. Of course, we can gather our forces and come to a greater state of calmness, and that too is our state of consciousness. But the question in our life always is, who am I? The second question that we ask is, what is lastingly real? Not merely what seems real in the moment, what affects me right now, but what is the enduring reality of my life? Because all of us experience that living in this world is just like being on an ocean all the time. The waves go up, the waves go down, the waves go up, the waves go down. I haven't myself raised children, but I remember my father in America, families tend not to stay together. And my own personal karma was such that I chose a good family. I incarnated into a good family that raised me well and helped me in many ways. But I didn't have a deep connection with my parents because my destiny really was somewhere else. So even though I was fond of them and always was good to them, and they were always good to me, deeper in my heart, I knew that, you know, my soul knew that I was going to go at a young age into the ashram, and that would be my life. At Ananda, we don't cut our ties with our family, but still. But I remember, and it still, to this day, is a very difficult memory for me, when my father realized, and we had been very close when I was growing up, when my father realized that my childhood was over and I was going off into my own life and what had been between us was not going to be there anymore, which it wasn't, because when I began to manifest my adult self, the interests I have were simply not his interests, and there was no way to reconcile our lives. He wanted a life for me that was unthinkable for me, and I was in a life that he couldn't comprehend, and he wept. It's one of the few times that I saw my father weep. And he said these words to me, the child disappears into the adult, is how he put it. You know, and I've seen it now. I'm old enough to have watched the raising of all my children's friends. I see Brian, who's a friend, sitting behind the camera there. I knew Brian when he was small enough to crawl under a chair when you talked to him because he was very shy. So this big man now is just a tiny baby, and I know his family, and I've watched him grow, and I've seen it all. We've all seen it. Children are the way that time passes, we watch it. But what is really lastingly real? Is it the fun that my father and I had together? The happiness that was dependent on my being a devoted child to him? Or is there some other reality that is underneath all of that, that transcends it, that is not changed even when circumstances change? Because that circumstances will change, we can absolutely depend on. I mean, we all know these things, but it takes great commitment as a spiritual person to look at them squarely and courageously accept the implications of this, and more deeply, to accept the responsibility for our own happiness that this teaching demands of us. Because what this takes away from us is the pleasant ability to blame other people or God for our own misunderstandings. It's like we take the school exam, we miss the questions, and then we blame the teacher for asking questions that I didn't know the answers to. And we think it's the teacher's fault that I failed the test because he should have asked me questions that I could have answered better. And so we live our lives, and I watch between parents and children especially, between fathers and daughters I see especially because I know that. How could my father not have become attached to the pleasure of having me as his daughter. I was a charming child, and I was completely devoted to him. And then when I got old enough, I just walked away. I mean, walked away in a certain sense, not in a cruel way, but the relationship had to change. So either this whole life is a cruel trick, or something else is being asked of us. So, who am I? What is lastingly real? And then where does my happiness come from? Where does it come from? What is it that's really giving me happiness? And the corollary to that is, what really causes me pain? Now, the most fascinating thing about pleasure and pain, happiness and sorrow, bliss and suffering, all of these opposites, is that the only place that they are experienced is inside our own consciousness. You know, that which is painful for one person is not painful for another. Living the life of a renunciate, which I have, even though I have married, am married, I have had the attitude of a renunciate all my life. When I was in my early years, all through my 20s, when I lived in really extremely primitive conditions, if you looked at them objectively, at Ananda Village, sometimes people would come, and I lived in a trailer. We just think it was probably half the size of this little bit of a stage here. It was just a little wider than that. And we do the energization exercises, which has a gesture that goes like that. Well, I had to do it like that because I couldn't go all the way up, except there was one little skylight where I could kind of shoot my hand up. But for years, I energized like that when I did it inside. And there was a place for me to sit, there was a place for me to cook food, there was a place for me to sleep, and there was a place for me to meditate. All life functions were right there. There was no bathroom, and later I got a cold, there was a water tap outside, and then later the water ran in, cold water ran in. I had a little burner, I would boil water. When I met bucket baths in India, I'd been taking them for years. It was nothing special to me. I never once thought of that as anything but luxurious. It was so comfortable. All my needs were met. It was entirely my own. It was in a beautiful setting, just stuck in the woods. And sometimes people would look at it and say, "How could you live that way?" And I would say, "What way? Like, what are you talking about?" It's all just in how we orient ourselves, what we expect. To me, that little place that I lived in was my ability to be part of this great work, to learn from Swami Kriyananda, to practice meditation. And it was just so marvelously unencumbered. Now, of course, and this is something I want to speak more about later, but the sense of poverty is to want things that you don't have the magnetism to create for yourself. And then you feel deprived. You want things that you don't have the magnetism, you don't have the energy, that your desires are bigger than your energy. And when your desires are bigger than your energy, you always feel deprived. When your energy is bigger than your desires, you always feel like you just have so many riches. The energy of our life was so much bigger, we solved the problem very simply. We had no money, we could have nothing, so therefore we wanted nothing. It would just seem to me like common sense. There was no point of thinking about new clothes or travel or luxuries or anything. We simply couldn't have it. So why even go there? It's actually very simple to be extremely poor. Being in the middle is difficult, trying to decide how to manage with just a certain amount. But what is lastingly real? Who am I? Where does my happiness come from? In those years, it was so simple. You know, I am a devotee seeking God. The only thing that is lastingly real is my relationship with the divine, and my happiness comes from answering that divine call. Everything else then is extra. Now, I'm not foolish enough to not understand that it's not so simple just to snap your fingers and find yourself there. My life became more complicated later, but the lessons of that time were not lost. Now, every time that anything happens to us in our life, any physical event, any relationship with a person, any thought in our own mind, even though we're not analyzing it, We are always answering that question in a certain way. And the word vibration is the best way to understand it, because it takes it away from your thoughts, your belief, your religion. If we imagine a spectrum of vibrations, a possibility of vibrations, which actually literally corresponds to the chakras, but for now I'm going to make it horizontal and put it like this. At this end is the state of God realization that these masters have, where we know ourselves to be one with the infinite, and we are fearless and without concern, just as the masters live. They haven't the slightest concern. Yogananda says, to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. That's a pretty challenging state of consciousness, but that's what he puts out. Nothing could touch him. What could touch him? There was one reality in his universe, and that universe was divine bliss, Satchidananda. If everything is Satchidananda, where is pain? Where is suffering? You know, it's all one reality. No matter what the waves on the ocean are doing, there's only one reality. So that's where we're going. Then there's all the space in between to the consciousness of I am a physical body, I am my ego, what matters to me is the only thing that matters. And you see people who do impossibly cruel things, imagining, because it's always true, that somehow that's going to make them happy. I read a remarkable story in a magazine about a man in America who came from a very difficult background and had never been raised with any right understanding. And when he grew older, as a young man, he murdered a woman just to get the money from her. He just wanted her money, so he just killed her and took her purse, just indifferently. The mother of the woman who had been killed, the man was found out by the police, he was convicted, he was sent to prison. He wasn't executed, but he was sent to prison for a long time. The mother of the woman who had been killed, her life just came to pieces. And she was angry all the time about what had happened, as you can well imagine. And she became angry at the man who had killed her daughter. She became angry at God for making it happen, until she began to realize that not only had her daughter been killed, but she was killing herself with her attitude. And she was wise enough to realize that this was not a way of life for her. So she had the thought that maybe if she went and confronted the man who'd killed her daughter, that somehow that would help her. So she went to see him. And at first, of course, it was somewhat difficult even to be in his company, but gradually she began to try to understand. And she was astonished to find out that he had no idea of the consequences of his behavior. That who am I? Where does my happiness come from? What is real? He answered those questions. I'm a man. I want her money. She doesn't want to give it to me. I'll just get rid of her. His unity with her spirit, the karmic consequences of his own action, the trivial nature of the money he wanted compared to the crime he was committed, he wasn't aware of any of it. He was way down here on the spectrum between God consciousness and here. Now, the end of that story is that only when he was looking at the mother of the woman he killed did it gradually penetrate his mind what he had done. And his awareness began to move up the scale. And of course, the end of the story is quite remarkable, that she more or less adopted him as a son. And together they went on a journey of healing. It was deeply touching to hear it, because she understood that he didn't know what he was doing. He thought that action would make him happy, and he didn't know. So every time we do something, of course, no one in this room is going to be as far down the scale as that man, but how many times have we allowed ourselves to take what we think of as our happiness at the expense of someone else? Either we do it out of ignorance, because we just don't realize the consequences, or we do it because we want to, because what we want seems more important to us than what someone else wants. Now, I'm not saying this gets to be a slightly complicated issue, because sometimes what you want is more important than what someone else wants, but that's a different question. Now, every time we respond to life in any way, we are registering our state of consciousness. And it doesn't go away because we're ego identified with our own actions. Ego is the infinite spirit identified with the physical body or the astral body, and all that happens, we believe, relates to us. I do it. I'm identified with it. It doesn't just go away. The masters have no identification with their body. They're identified with the infinite. Because we are identified with our unique individuality, the karma of our own actions stays with us. We believe that we have done it. We have done it out of personal desire. And in the chakras, from the bottom to the top of the spine, each of those chakras corresponds to a vibration of consciousness somewhere on the spectrum. Who am I? What is lastingly real? Where does my happiness come from? And it stays with us because we identify with it. And it stays with us, as you know, from one incarnation to the next. The chakras are part of the astral body. The physical body goes away. The astral body is what we take with us. And our consciousness is defined by the vrittis in the chakras. And the next incarnation and the next incarnation and the next incarnation are all a very impersonal scientific expression of the kind of energy that we ourselves have created lifetime after lifetime. And that's why absolutely every thought that you think matters. Every action that you take matters. And this isn't a question of praying to God, not praying to God, answering the prayers, not answering the prayers. This is just who we are. This is an energy universe, and we are an energy pattern. And that energy pattern is created by the actions and the thoughts that we take. Now, here's just one more thing. It's created by the intention of what we do. I mean, that man who murdered, even though it was an evil action on his part, it wasn't a deliberate desire to hurt that woman. That's an even lower state of consciousness, a desire that gets its pleasure from causing pain to others. It was simply that he was unconscious of the pain he was causing because he was so intent on getting the money. You see the difference? And very often in our lives, we do things that have unintended bad consequences because other people misunderstand or circumstances turn out differently. So the comforting fact in all of this is God reads the heart. That's how Swamiji put it. God understands what we really intend. And it's our state of consciousness that is registered, not the endless ramifications of every action that we take. So at any point in our lives, we are standing here and our magnetism, which is the effect of the energy of who we are, is radiating out in all directions and is our karma in the sense that it's the attracting force that brings to us our opportunities or the repelling force that prevents those opportunities from coming. And working with that flow of energy in the right way is really the only truly effective way to influence our destiny. Now, I'm going to pause for a moment and give you a chance to ask questions to see if we are understanding each other. Any questions or thoughts on what I've said? Yes. Karma, the result of desires, the intention behind the desires, or the attachment to those desires. If you could, all of those words are words that have subtle nuance of meaning. So it's a little bit hard to parse it apart that way. The first thing we have to understand is that karma is, there's the word metaphysics. You know, physics we understand as the science, and metaphysics is a word people use. Metaphysics is a good word in this because these are like mathematical relationships. These are not God loves this one, God doesn't love this one, I'm a good person, he's a bad person. This is like we vibrate at a certain understanding. And whether we call it attachment, desire, intention like that is less important than the fact that we just simply vibrate at a certain intention. And that's registered. That's the only way I could think to say it. So naturally, all of those factors play in. But when we get more at ease with living according to this truth, which is why I really wanted to share it with all of you, because if we can get really a clear feeling in our hearts about how to influence our own destiny, this was the question you raised, how do I integrate my spiritual and my material life? There's really no difference at all between your spiritual and material life, because everything is an affirmation of a state of consciousness and an effort to rise to a higher state of consciousness. And whether you're doing it in meditating, whether you're doing it in business, whether you're doing it with your children, it's really all the same. Where on the spectrum of who am I, what is lastingly real, where does my happiness come from? We have to answer that question in every circumstance. And we simply try to answer it as effectively as we can, balancing all those factors. Yes. Well, his karma would not be as bad as if he genuinely thought to gain happiness by causing pain to others. You could see the thought form that if I hurt you, that will make me happy, is a worse thought form than give me your purse. And so that's what I mean by the fact that it's not entirely, intention counts for something. Sometimes we just simply do things having no idea of the consequences, and God is not cruel. No, there's a purpose here. We are getting an education. We're not just meeting these artificial standards. So if we're getting that education, that's what matters. And so when we understand a mistake and then really understand on a higher level, then it's finished. It's just gone. It's no longer something that we have to be tortured by. Not entirely, because we may still have a force in motion that might have to finish, which is I'll speak about in a moment, about how the lessons are learned. Does that make sense? It's very comforting. It's very comforting. Yesterday someone asked, I see the gentleman's not in the room, but somebody asked, you know, how you can be kind to yourself. And I mentioned that that was a struggle for me for many years in my earlier life. Until one day I finally just realized that I'm doing the best I can. And I've had this idea in my mind that somehow I was capable of living a perfect life, that I realized it was just pride and ego that pretended I could live that life, that this one, however mediocre it might be, is the best that I can do. And I began to realize that if this is the best I can do, then God doesn't hate me. He's not. If I'm 6 years old, he's not angry because I can't do algebra. I'm only six. But so then I can, you know, I can say, I can write up my name and I can color in the squares. And from the point of view of spirituality, you know, if I'm 6 years old and I'm just coloring in the squares and writing my name, that's the best I can do. And if I do that well, then everything in future will improve. Because I was living a life where I expected myself to do something completely other. And so that's how we come to peace with our own reality. And you see, from the point of view of what I'm describing here, if we think, not only did I make this bad mistake, but I'm also a horrible, terrible person because I made this mistake, you've made two mistakes. And in many ways, the second one is worse. Because long after this is over, you'll still be doing this to yourself. So that question is, who am I? Am I my limitations? Or am I my divine potential? So oftentimes your freedom is in just being very casual about your mistakes. Because if I am the infinite spirit, then yes, these things happen. I mustn't hide from them. But I am the infinite spirit. That's what's lastingly real. Where does my happiness come from? You know, not from hating myself for these errors, but from accepting that these things happen and that I can go forward from here. Just like a student failing, you fail an exam, you spend the rest of your life thinking you're a failure because you failed the exam. People do that. They'll fail in one area and they'll spend the rest of their life defined by that failure. Where is the wisdom in that? But we do that to ourselves all the time without noticing how wrong that is. Does that make sense? Another question? By the time, the question is karma just the actions you take? By the time something it manifests in this world, there's a whole lot of other energies behind it. And all of those are just as real. And in fact, what finally happens is almost incidental to all the consciousness that goes along before it. In Autobiography of a Yogi, there's a section called How to Outwit a Mosquito. And you remember, Yogananda is being tormented by a mosquito, and he's sitting in front of his guru, and he wants to slap the mosquito, but then he thinks of Ahimsa, and he says, no, I shouldn't kill the mosquito. And Sri Yukteswar says, you've already killed it in your mind, you might as well slap it with your hand, meaning that by the time you do this, you've already set the energy in motion. I had a very interesting experience with my husband once that taught me just a lot about inner reactions. We had a motorhome, which is, you know, like a big trailer on wheels, and you live inside of it and you drive it. It wasn't ours, but we were using it. And it was large enough that it had a small kitchen in the back so that when my husband was driving on the highway, I could be back in the kitchen making meals. Of course, if the road was a little curvy, that wasn't always easy. And we were on a somewhat curvy road, and he drifted a little over to one side and made a rather sharp turn to get back. I was in the back, and I had a jar of peanut butter. I don't know if you have peanut butter here, but it's a heavy jar like this, about a pound jar. And I was making a sandwich. And when he made that shift, the jar just slid right off the counter, and it fell right on my foot. Fortunately, you know, it just made a bruise, that was all. But as I felt the pain in my foot, I had an almost irresistible desire. I resisted it, but almost irresistible to yell at him. And it was like, my foot hurts. If I yell at him, somehow my foot won't hurt so much. But I caught the thought and realized, my foot's still going to hurt. And then he'll just be a little upset with me, and then he'll get upset back, and then I'll get upset with him, and this whole negative thing will just roll forward. But it was amazing to me how the idea that if I have pain, if I pass that pain on to someone else, that in some way it will diminish the pain that I have, you see? And that to me ever since has been such an extraordinary teaching to me. So when you say, you yell at someone, why would you yell at someone? Perhaps they have done something that has made you uncomfortable. And so now I am uncomfortable, so let me see if I can make you uncomfortable. And that we have the idea in our minds, where does my happiness come from? Oh, my happiness comes from making you suffer as I'm suffering. And, of course, that's not the right answer.
Sometimes it works.
Okay, then we have to ask the next question, and I know you're joking, but the next question is, what is lastingly true? So in the moment, every time my husband does something I don't like, I yell at him. Okay, how happy is our marriage over a long period of time? You know, how deep is our friendship? Every time your children do something you don't like, you try to make them do what you like. You know, how lastingly real is the satisfaction of imposing your will on them? How grateful are they going to be when they finally have enough power to not want you to do that anymore? So these are the questions that we ask repeatedly, and these set up the vibrations within us that cause us difficulty later on. Then all of a sudden we get a bright idea to be different, but we have all this weight of habit that we have to start working against. Okay? Because what we have to understand about karma and about the state of consciousness we have right now is that it's just the accumulated effect of all the decisions we've made up until now. And therefore, everything Sri Yukteswar says here, Sri Yukteswar says, everything in future will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now. We have this feeling, and it's a perfectly understandable feeling, that we are weighted down by the accumulative effect of all our past actions. And that's why people say, oh, it's just karma, there's nothing you can do about it, and so on. Well, it is karma, but there's everything you can do about it. Because it doesn't exist, it's not like a big rock. It's not like some huge physical object. It's a pattern of energy. And it was a pattern of energy that we created piece by piece by piece. And if now the answer to the question, who am I? What is lastingly real? Where does my happiness come from? Is different than the way we answered it yesterday or last incarnation. If we begin to build that magnetism into our chakras, then we simply recreate a new reality. But here's where the difficulty comes, which is it's metaphysics. So as much energy as we put into creating one reality, we have to now put out as much energy to create a new reality. Now that's not 100% true, because once we're trying to go toward the divine understanding, the grace of God comes and helps us. And yesterday some of you were there when someone asked me, what's the effect of Kriya? The effect of Kriya is that it dissolves that energy directly. So there's many ways you can speed the process, otherwise it would be very depressing. But no matter what condition we're in now, the answer to it is to put out the right energy at this point. Everything in future will improve if we make the right spiritual effort now. And if the obstacles we face are large, that just means we have to put out more energy in the right direction. But we are not trapped by anything. But what we have to understand, and this is another part of it, it took us a long time. We devoted a tremendous amount of energy to getting ourselves into the mess we're in right now. It's a little bit like if you're driving down the highway, in America we have all these freeways. I know you have these freeways here, but you can be going 90 miles an hour way over in the left lane of a highway, just whipping down the highway, and all of a sudden there's the turn that you meant to make, and you just shoot past it, and you realize that you're putting all your energy going in a direction now that you don't want to go in. You've totally changed your mind. You know where you want to be, but there's a certain amount of momentum in place. And so it takes time to slow the car down, to make sure that you have the space to move over, to find another exit, to make a U-turn, to get back on the highway, to get where you're wanting to go. But once you start that, you can do it, but you can't do it just the second you change your mind. And so part of what we have to face in coming to the idea of prosperity, whether it's material wealth or spiritual wealth, is to realize that we have a certain momentum in a certain direction and we're responsible for that momentum. But because we're responsible, if we just start in a new direction, then very quickly, relatively speaking, we can just make a U-turn and come back to where we need to be. And the effort required to do that sets in motion a whole nother wave of energy that then begins to help us go in the direction we want to go. Does that make sense? Do we understand that? Do we have any thoughts or questions about what I've said here? Yes. Oh, no, that's an extremely good question. The question is, if so many other people are miserable, how can I just be thinking about my own happiness? Okay, well, part of that, you see, is the question, where does my happiness come from? Does my happiness come from merely selfishly finding for myself what I want and making my position secure and to my liking? Or does my happiness come from sharing with others whatever understanding I have, or whatever material wealth I have, or whatever peace and calmness I have? And it seems self-evident that the more we identify with a greater reality, the more we are moving toward that state of God realization. That's the definition of a master, is that he's equally in all of us. So the very definition of self-realization, to think of it as something contained only within your individual self, is simply wrong. That very idea is actually the antithesis of self-realization. Self-realization is to identify as deeply with all of creation as you do with the individual jiva that is you, the individual life that you are responsible for. So then it becomes just a very simple question of, from a practical point of view, you know, what is going to give me the greatest capacity to help the world? I started my life with the idea of social service and helping underprivileged people and changing the political system and all of those sorts of things. Many of us begin there. But I saw that there seemed to be a force in the world that was determined to create suffering, that my little voice, you know, as a political protester or whatever I was doing, I found only that I became agitated and angry, discouraged and hopeless, and nothing around me changed. So I had to begin to ask myself the question, you know, where does my happiness come from throwing myself against this hopeless task? And so then I began to ask other questions. What is lastingly real here? In other words, why are these people suffering? What is the context that's causing it? All of which led me, eventually, to understand if I transform my consciousness and am able to relate to this world from a higher perspective that doesn't preclude the desire to ease the suffering, but understands even other people's suffering in the same context that I understand my own, then I can be genuinely helpful to people. I mean, in a very concrete way. You know, poverty is not as apparent in America as it sometimes is in India, but there are homeless people and drug-addicted people and people with mental problems who just live on the sidewalks. Such people used to frighten me. When I would see them, I would be frightened of them. I would be afraid to look at them. I would shrink from them. I couldn't go anywhere near them because I didn't understand why they were suffering, and their suffering hurt me. As I have worked on the spiritual path to understand karma, it doesn't make me any less sympathetic to them. In fact, it makes me more so to understand, my, you've really gotten yourself into quite a problem here, haven't you? But it doesn't frighten me anymore. And I can look right at a homeless person. I can relate to him. I can give him money if that's what I should do. I can at least greet him as a child of God or bless him from a distance if he's too crazy for me to deal with. Far from causing me to be less compassionate, the more I have understood, the more I feel like I can give. When I come to India, you know, when I've traveled with other Americans and you're besieged by beggars and so on, you can't always just empty your wallet. It's just an endless project, nor should you necessarily. But I realized I can always just look right at people and give them something of what Swamiji has given to me. And it's only this big, you know, of a contribution, but that's part of what I was saying to you at the beginning of this. The implications of this teaching require a tremendous amount of courage and honesty to really understand where it's going. We can just continue to rail at things if we want to, or we can seriously apply ourselves to making them different. And I said to some of you all last night, I feel like I'm intensely politically active because the problem, all of this problem is consciousness. All of this problem is, I hurt, let me hurt you. Where does my happiness come from getting as much as I can, regardless of what it does to you? You change that, and never underestimate the power of one individual who's deeply committed to have a tremendous impact. All changes in this world happen from very small groups of people who are deeply committed, among other reasons why we are a sangha and not merely a group of hermits. Because a sangha together like this, all of us working to change our consciousness, to understand these laws of karma, to work properly in harmony with a true understanding of God's place in our life, we can change the planet. We really can, and we will. I know about the life of Christ very powerfully. Jesus Christ was crucified as a criminal. He was left for dead. He resurrected, but nobody believed, very few believed that he actually did, that he had the power to restore his body. And his disciples dispersed, and anybody there would have thought that was the end of it. But the divine power was there, and a few individuals remained committed to it and never gave up, even though their own lives were then taken away from them. But the power was there. And everything in this world is really done by spiritual power. It's not done by politics. The politicians are the instruments of a greater destiny. What is lastingly real? That's the question. Where does real happiness and change come from? I hope that's helpful to you, because the question you ask is important. And then everybody finds their place. You may become a Kriya Yogi who lives in the slums and helps, you know, poor people in some small way to improve their lot. Or you may go off and be a hermit somewhere. Everybody has to do what their own destiny directs them to do. But if we do it with God consciousness instead of anger, then everything you see is different. Comments or thoughts? Yes. I appreciate that question. The question is, we want to be a perfect person. How do we get there? In a sense, I wanted to put the philosophical part down and then talk about what we do about it. But let me go right to where you're asking. Even this enormous task of moving from delusion to God realization, it only happens moment by moment. We tend to think of it as this vast distance that we have to move like that. Either I am nothing and I am everything. You know, I am a terrible person or I'm a realized person. And it doesn't happen that way. We change an inch at a time. And the characteristic of lower consciousness, I would use the word contractive. It takes the possibilities of the world and it reduces them smaller. And the possibilities of God realization is that it's a more expanded view. That the gentleman in the back was trying to describe God realization as becoming utterly self-concerned, but that's completely the opposite. In every situation in our life, we always have a choice. There's always a way we can go, whether we are more expanded in the way we respond to it or whether we're more contractive in the way we respond to it. Another way to put that is we either put out a little more energy or we put out a little less energy. Now, it is not an absolute yes or no. It is just in relation to where I'm standing, in relation to what I actually have the capacity to do. Do I go toward the more expansive choice that's in front of me or the less expansive choice? I'll give you a very personal example, ridiculous example, talking about husbands and wives. My husband and I were traveling on a vacation. It had to do with buying presents for other people. I kept saying we needed to shop for presents. He was not into doing it. When he finally brought up that we should shop for presents, it was too late to shop as carefully as I wanted to, and I was very annoyed with him. And I became very annoyed with him when we were in the middle of a shopping place, because that's when the issue came up. And I was really mad at him. And I wanted to just yell at him right in the moment. Now, I thought to myself, this is really a misunderstanding that has to be worked out. So I thought, can I just Christ-like forgiveness? Can I just forgive him and forget this? And I thought, no, that's not really an option. So then I went over here and I thought, do I pick up my purse and do I just whack him around the head? And I thought, no, I don't have to do that. I'm not that upset. So then I thought, do I start making a scene right in this public place? No, I can move a little bit away from that. Let's at least get outside to the stores, out of the store. So we got all the way to the sidewalk. By the time I get to the sidewalk, I'm testing about whether I can just forgive him. No, I still can't go there. But now I'm beginning to understand a little more that he didn't really mean to cause this grief. He just wasn't thinking about it. He's not as tuned in to the question of buying presents for people as I am. So I got us all the way to the sidewalk, I got all the way to the car, I got all the way to the apartment, at which point I keep testing whether I can let the issue go. No, I can't let it go. But by the time we got to the apartment, I had expanded to the point where I no longer needed to pass along my annoyance. I had begun to understand his reality. I began to see that he wasn't trying to hurt me. And so by the time we talked about it, I had expanded to the point where we still had to have a strong discussion. I couldn't let it go, But I had moved a long way from where I started. Okay? Surprisingly, if every time you have an issue, you go to the highest side that you are actually capable of going, and that will not be where you hope to go, you'll be amazed how quickly everything begins to shift. Because you are trying to answer that question, where does my happiness come from? Who am I? In a different way every time. Let's say you have a problem with eating too many chocolates, and you have a box of chocolates in front of you, and you know that you're going to have the whole box of chocolates and you're going to eat all of them. Okay? You quickly take half of them and you put them in the garbage disposal, and you turn on the garbage disposal and you destroy them, and then you only eat half the box. Okay? You've still eaten half the box of chocolates, but you have done a little better than you thought you were going to do. If you're lazy and you need to wash the dishes, I know many of you have people to take care of things like that, but say you have to wash the dishes and you don't feel like doing it right now. Okay, I'll compromise. I'll just stack them up instead of just leaving them a mess. And then between the most contracted expression and the most expanded expression, you have at least gone up. And if you only think about your life, just let me expand from here. Now, you see, the other thing about expanded and contracted, it's not always obvious. Sometimes people, contracted for them is to say nothing. If the habit of life is to be afraid to speak up, to never to express your point of view, to feel that God doesn't want to hear your voice, that nobody wants to know you. Sometimes for you, silence is contractive and you have to speak. If you're afraid to say what your reality is, then expansive for you is to speak. So it's not a matter of being nice or not being nice. A person who's always angry needs self-control. A person who's afraid to speak out needs to be more forceful in the way they speak. Expanded or contracted, that's what we're looking here. Who am I? Where does my happiness come from? You have to take the spiritual path, which is this big, and reduce it down to something you can do every morning, every day, at the office. Your boss asks you to do an unpleasant task. You know you want to snap at him. You may have to tell him that it can't be done, but you can tell him either in a contractive, angry way, or you can tell him in a calm, centered way. You may still accomplish the same thing, but you choose in the spectrum here. Does that make sense? Is that a practical thought? Is that challenging? Oh, sure. Did anyone ever say this would be easy? No. But we're trying to make it doable. That's all. We're just trying to make it doable. Otherwise, these are just ideas that spin. We have to be able to take these ideas and put them in our lives right now. Exactly. In people think in meditation, people say to me, I can't meditate, my mind is restless. Honey, everyone's mind is restless. That's the nature of it. But we just keep bringing it back. Everybody's life is a little bit out of control, and we're always doing things that we shouldn't do, and we're rarely acting perfectly. But we just act. The word is directional. If we're moving in the right direction, because you see, there's another factor. I'm talking about this very impersonally. We have a loving divine mother who is so eager to help us. But if we have our back turned to her and we're just sort of doing like this, you know, all of you who are parents or friends, if your child won't accept your help, you can't help your child. You know, I'm going to do it myself. And the father is just sitting there. I could help you in so many ways, but the child won't be helped. So he just has to spin. Divine Mother's just the same way. And if all we're trying to do are things that she knows are not going to be good for us, she can't help us. But as soon as we even just face the right direction, then she starts inspiring us and pulling us and teaching us in so many ways that much more happens than you would think would happen. And it becomes much more beautiful and more easy. Does that make sense? I'm going to give you a chance to drink tea. Yes? So let's take, how long is our break, Devendra?
10 minutes.
Okay, let's take 10 minutes. Let's go off and have tea for 10 minutes and then we'll come back.